Dear Asian Girl, for Asian girls, by Asian girls.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Dear Asian Girl, a podcast for Asian girls by Asian girls. I'm Naina, co-hosting with Isabel, and today we're going to be talking about South Asian creators. And we actually discussed this earlier with Rhea Shetty, who, for context, she's South Indian. So we had great conversations about hierarchies between North and South India, and then also how South Asian fashion and culture wear is being treated and interacted with by South Asian communities and non-South Asian communities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now we're here discussing with Mahua Khan. And going to this episode, I want to first preface with how, when deciding and looking for guests, we definitely want to have more than one speaker. I believe it was Isabel's idea originally, where we would have this panel-like feel where we can have at least more than one take on the South Asian experience, since South Asian is so much more broad than merely India. And it's really important to decenter India as the one South Asian country. So we are so glad to have you here as a Bangladeshi American artist.
Mahua is a co-host of the Difficult Dish podcast, and it aims to illuminate listeners on the experiences of being in a Desi household. And Mahua is also a freshly master's graduate, congratulations, as you completed the childhood education program to pursue personal love for storytelling and education. And this is especially true with your work as the director and editor of the Bangladeshi Development Project, which is centered around counteracting a number of societal issues in Bangladesh.
And I know you run your own small business, Labyrinthav. Correct me if I'm wrong, is that how you pronounce it?
Great, yes, Labyrinthav.
And in New York. And you're also the co-host of the podcast Difficult Dish, which I had to listen to. It's pretty great. It's really good.
I really enjoyed it too.
Oh my god, yeah. What episode?
The most recent one.
Oh my god, thank you so much. That means so much.
Did you finish your first season and like stopping
there?
Yeah.
We finished your season after like a year almost, like 44 episodes, 42 episodes, and so now we're doing season 2 next week.
Gotcha. Yeah, I remember I was listening to I'm yet to listen to the self-care in South Asian households. But that's going to be on my list because that is very relevant. But yeah, and you also just graduated recently, so you're busy and you are pretty successful from my definition. And yeah, please share more about Labyrinthav, any other things you have ongoing in your life right now, anything you want our listeners to know, and yeah, just take away.
I'm trying to think if you missed anything. I feel like you plugged everything pretty well. I also do YouTube and a lot of other content creation. I'm just trying to, you know, expand as much as I can. And now that I have graduated, I do have more free time to actually expand and not stress over school. But I'm trying my best to, you know, stay sane by doing so many things at once. I am trying to do more designs for Labyrinthav and expand on that as well. But yeah, you guys covered it really well. I have a lot of female supporters, and I could not be more blessed, because honestly, I feel much more confident and just safer. And I feel like my message goes towards women a lot more better. And I feel like it's more receptive towards them. And I also have a lot of young girls that follow me, and they are trying to get advice on moving out or getting more independent, getting out of their comfort zone. You know, a bunch of things. So a lot of them are in New York, a lot of them are in the US, a lot of them are in India, Canada, different places. So that's my demographic for the most part, but it does range from, you know, all ages. My YouTube is a lot, very much like New York based. A lot of people want to see like New York apartments and New York moving out videos. And yeah, so over the past few years of me growing my platforms, it's been just a lot of young girls coming to my page to just learn how to be more confident, just learn how to, you know, question a lot of traditional norms. And it's been really nice. I think originally when I first started, you know, never with the intention of growing as like a content creator or anything like that. But when I first started, it was kind of just me like posting pictures. Like when I made an Instagram in like 2014, when it first came out, and I had a lot of males like following me because of the pictures I was posting. But now I'm really grateful to say that it's a lot of girls that are following me.
What helped you decide to start posting things about the South Asian experience and talking about how to like move out of your household or be more independent in your household?
I think, well, first, originally, it was never with the intent of like trying to reach people. I think first I was making it because I wanted a place to just put my thoughts out, and it was kind of like my personal diary. And then once people started relating to it and people started, well, I started seeing that it was kind of like a topic that was pushed under the rug and it was kind of taboo, I realized that there was a demand for it and people want to see this information put out because, you know, no one really talks about it. So I started making these videos, even though I do get some backlash sometimes because people don't really understand why I talk about, you know, taboo topics, like why not just leave it under the rug. I feel like it's really worth it because I reach a lot of people at the end of the day, and these topics that they can't have with their family members. And a lot of people are stuck because, you know, they do want to move out or they do want to pursue an unconventional path and like they don't know how to. So they want like some sort of advice or like someone that has done it. And I think it's really important to, you know, with like all the knowledge that I've gained over the past few years with like my business and just like wisdom from life experiences, I feel like it's my duty to share it with whoever I can and help whoever else is going through it, you know.
Yeah, so did you have like a figure that was you in the sense, like did you have any representation of what you wanted to be when you grew up, when you were in high school maybe?
Honestly, growing up, I didn't have that many people to look up to, especially because I grew up in like the early 2000s, and I was actually talked about on my podcast, I said that like the only person I had really was like a girl named Mohini from Lemonade Mouth, or like Beck from Victorious, or like,
yeah.
But those are like guys, like, you know, it wasn't very known to have any brown representation. And if there was, it was kind of negative. So there weren't really positive forms of representation until I got older. And like, I started getting into space as well, because, you know, now we have like actresses, and now we have, you know, Bridgerton, we have so many different things, but it definitely did take a long time to get into that place. So I'm so happy that people now have that representation, but growing up we definitely did not have the best form of like healthy representation, you know.
Yeah. And did you notice that you didn't have any representation, or were you kind of just not think about it?
I don't think I really thought of it, because when you're growing up it's just like you just see what you see. So I saw Hannah Montana, I saw like Selena Gomez and on Disney. And it's just, you see what you see in front of you. You don't even think to see any brown people on media because like you've never seen it before. And so you don't think that they should be in media because the only people you've seen around you are like your white teachers or like whoever you see in media. And like the brown people are in like the specified like doctor, engineer route. So it's like, you don't even know that you need it because you never grew up around it in the first place. So it's like, it's something that you never knew in the first place. So I never even knew it was missing from my life because like I never had it in the first place. So now it's just really nice that people have that option, you know?
Yeah, and you mentioned there's been this positive growth from when you were growing up in the 2000s with Disney Channel only giving us like Lemonade Mouth or Robbie from Jesse, you know, two pretty good things, but still pretty formative. And now we're in, you know, 2022 when we have Bridgerton season 2 here for us. And I know it was a huge thing for the South Asian community. It was a huge thing for me, but it was, you know, centering India as South Asia. And I never really stopped to think about what is it like, or what are the next steps that should be taken for other smaller South Asian countries that are still needing and lacking representation. Like, as a Bangladeshi, have you sat down to think about that? Because often, like you said, you never really sit down in the moment to think about, oh, I'm here in this like timeline, and I'm thinking about it in terms of the progress of representation. Not many people often sit down to do that because we usually let the media dictate what we think is like even possible for representation. So I'm wondering, have you sat down to think about like, oh, where is this Bangladeshi representation? Or like, have you ever felt like you are lacking and yearning for it almost?
Yeah. Well, I think that when people see brown representation in media, there is like a sense of celebration because, you know, we don't have brown representation in the first place. But I think after that, it's like a lot of people want like the Bangladeshi representation or like the Nepali representation. And that is needed. And I've seen when those cultures are represented or those ethnicities are represented, there's also kind of like a hate towards them because some people feel like the other ethnicity, like it feels like no one wants to kind of celebrate the individual ethnicities because they feel like their culture should be showcased more, or like there's a competition with another culture. So I do think that there still needs to be a lot of work to be done, but I think right now there needs to be a celebration in general with just like brown skin and people in the brown space, because I feel like there's just like a weird like competition type of thing that I don't really like, because you know, someone might say like, oh, she's dark skinned, but how about like the Latinos? Like, why aren't we in Bridgerton? We never get representation. And that's valid. That's true that a lot of Latino people don't get representation. But at the end of the day, this is like the spotlight for brown people, you know? And beyond that, a lot of people will say, well, how come, you know, India was in Bridgerton, but not Bangladesh people? Or like, even in the Marvel show right now, like, why is like an Afghani actor the actor for this character, but not like an actual Pakistani guy, you know? Like, there's just so many different like levels to it. And I think that we are headed in the right direction, but I think like the individual countries and like the individual ethnicities, that will take a little bit longer. But right now we should still celebrate the people that are getting to the top and like representing us, you know, because that's something that we never had when we were younger. And we should just be happy with what we have right now and still work towards getting to that place with our individual countries as well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree with what you said. I think celebration, regardless of whether you are a part of the Indian community and you were experiencing Bridgerton season 2 come out, you can still be in solidarity and celebration as a POC, because I feel like going down the path of representation for brown people is also a win for other brown people that aren't Indian or other POC people that aren't Indian. And I really felt that aspect you brought up of competition and how it can be very toxic. And then also the notion of wanting to say like, oh, you have this, but what about this whole list of communities that is yet to be represented? To me, that almost starts to feel like tokenism, because it feels like a check mark. They have to just check off a list. And I think simply saying that in response to an underrepresented group finally getting representation in a beautiful manner, I feel like it's definitely taking away that celebration and downplaying the efforts and the success of that. And also with Bridgerton, I feel like we are seeing these women, in South Asian women, Indian women, in spaces of beauty, in spaces of desirability and attraction, without like exotifying it or commodifying South Asian culture or fashion or physical attributes. And I think you also do that with your clothing brand and the accessories you create with Labyrinthoff, because I was looking through the website and I really personally loved how you had these South Asian figures adorned with saris and nose jewelry and beautiful South Asian clothing and jewelry. And I also really love the Urdu words that you have and other things in general, like representing Pakistani cultural symbols or other cultural symbols. That was interesting to see, because you're showcasing South Asian culture in this light of beauty, in this light of attraction, which I think is really important. So I wanted to ask you, what was that journey of creating Labyrinthoff, and how do you think it's helping you with your own South Asian identity, and how do you think it's helping other people find representation for their own South Asian identity?
Well, thank you so much for saying all that first. When I first made Labyrinthoff 2 years ago, it was originally just me making clothing and art about just Bangladesh. And then once that gained a little bit of popularity, a lot of people wanted countries that were related to them and cultures and stuff like that. So I wanted to branch out and represent more South Asian people to, you know, make them feel good as much as the Bangladeshi people were feeling when they were wearing the Bangladeshi apparel. So I started branching out, and it's been really crazy to like see how many people from all around the world have bought my stuff, and it's just like really nice to hear the stories. So there was this woman who lives in the Midwest or somewhere in the Northwest in the US, and she messaged me saying that she never grew up around any Bangladeshi people. And when she bought for me, that was like the first ever time that she saw, you know, her country on a shirt and just like anything in general related to her culture. And it made her feel like really, really nice and wholesome. And she also married a German man. So she has never grown up around that. And when she received it, she was just very, very happy. And she was like showing it off to her kids. And like just comments like that make me feel very just happy that I started it, because it like really helps people embrace themselves through fashion and just art. And I think even people like me, when I grew up in a very white dominated area, if I had something like that, it would have made me, you know, somehow get closer to my culture in like a very subtle way and just embrace it. And I think a lot of people need that, especially when they don't have brown influence around them, or, you know, brown people on social media or on the media. And it's just really nice that I'm able to do that through fashion. So now 2 years later, I'm just kind of branching out and out. It's been really nice to just reach so many people. I think the one setback is just like, since I am just one person, it's very hard for me to just like mass produce so many different countries at the same time. So I know a lot of people have asked me to make, you know, like Afghanistan or like the Maldives or like different countries that I'm not able to produce right away. And I think just like the one setback has been, you know, how quick I can make things. A lot of people feel like I'm leaving them out, even though it's not my intention to like just leave them out. I just can't make it fast enough.
Yeah, I feel like as people start to view content creators as someone that can be a representation for South Asian community, for example, there starts to be this misconception that they are able to hit like every single marginalized minority group in general within that large umbrella of South Asia, which is completely unrealistic. You're only one woman. You can only pack so many things in a time frame. You can only produce so many things in a time frame. So I wanted to ask, as a creator that is part of a largely underrepresented minority group, what has your experience been carrying the weight of representation, whether it's through feeling that pressure to churn out as many diverse apparel you can, or in general, just feeling as if you have to be the spokesperson for the South Asian community or the Bangladeshi community, because there's not much specifically Bangladeshi representation that people may have?
I think as a South Asian creator, a lot of people think that my experience is everyone else's experience. So like, since I make a lot of content, you know, around like taboo topics and just talking about different things in the South Asian community, a lot of people think that, well, not a lot, but like there's a few comments in there that say that, you know, I'm generalizing and that I should also talk about like a man's experience or like a mother's experience or like different things that I don't have. I can't talk about that because I'm not a man, I'm not a mother, you know? So a lot of people think that I have to kind of encompass every single person's experience, and that's not possible, you know? Like, gratefully, I have been able to talk about my own story and stories that I've heard, and people have been able to resonate with it. And that's the reason that I make videos and, you know, my content. Everything else has been really nice. It's been really nice to resonate with a lot of people, because a lot of people, first of all, don't know how to express themselves, not even like an elegant way, but they just don't know the words to express themselves, or they just like have never been taught to express themselves, or they just never even knew that it was happening. Like, they just felt it sometimes in their head and they just like didn't know who to talk to about it, or like whatever it is. So it's been really nice to like put the words in people's mouths. And it's been just nice to like start conversations and to allow people to choose themselves and just question things, you know? Like, I know I already upset a lot of people with like the topics that I choose to talk about. So I don't want to like go beyond that and just make other people mad as well.
Yeah. And we were talking to Rhea about how on TikTok, a lot of the times to gain traction on your content, you have to choose extreme or polarizing statements to say about a certain topic to gain likes and comments or just any type of traction. And I think that like really plays into like the whole idea of like cancel culture. You know, we have to try to talk about things in a way that are kind of like mild.
Sometimes like if I don't want to talk about it directly through a video, just because it's too personal, I'll make an art piece about it, you know? So I have different forms of art things that I can use to talk about different things. So I think I have talked about everything that I needed to talk about through whichever form, which is really nice. Like if I want to be really hidden, I'll use my art to like talk about it.
I'm wondering if you recall any specific issues that you were talking about that were particularly controversial or that you may have received a lot of backlash about. I can imagine, I know you've discussed double standards with like guys versus girls in South Asian households. Maybe that was one of the topics you faced backlash on.
Yeah. I think recently I've had a lot of backlash with one of the videos that I posted talking about like toxic relationships in South Asian culture. It was pretty recent. It was like in the past 2 weeks. I had a few comments talking about how not all men are like that. And I should be looking at my own father and my own grandfather if I'm talking about toxic relationships. And essentially the video was talking about like, you know, a lot of us accept toxic relationships and toxic love in South Asian culture because we grew up with like our dads only, you know, doing the work, like being the breadwinners, whereas like our moms were like the caretakers and like stay-at-home moms. And we saw like our dads yelling at their daughters and like, you know, just like really bad treatment towards the girls. And so now we accept it as we get older. And a lot of males were really mad about that because they said that, you know, a lot of them aren't like that. And, you know, they're just like very butthurt over it. And a lot of people also got mad about the fact because I mentioned religion and how in Islam, a lot of guys want really modest girls because they just like expect them to like take care of them completely and all of that. So a lot of guys were upset about it. So I think I got a lot of backlash on that specifically because it hit like a soft spot in guys, you know? So a lot of people were like, oh, you're generalizing. Not all guys are like this, like blah, blah, blah. And I never said all guys were like that, but I said like typically in South Asian culture, there is like a toxic level where like if there is a toxic relationship with your parents, they can't speak up about it, you know? And so now as we're older in this generation, like we think the same thing because we accept this toxic love and we can't like get a divorce. We can't talk to anyone about it.
I really related to the post. I remember seeing that and my initial reaction was, first of all, how true it was. And you talk about like the stigma around getting a divorce. That is so real. I've heard the worst horror stories of family friends. Like this one horrible story of one of my family friends, a friend of my mom's, she had her husband was just violating so many levels and boundaries. Like he did not trust the wife at all for no particular reason, no justifiable reason. And he would have cameras installed in every single one of the rooms because, you know, Indian men, like STEM majors, right? So he used his technology skills and she didn't have an education because growing up in India, that wasn't what she could be allowed to do without getting a lot of backlash and without, you know, receiving a lot of hate for that. So there's this huge disparity in education and power dynamics. So all this privacy was violated and she still felt like she couldn't get a divorce because of like whatever holiday trips that he paid for because, you know, he had to be the breadwinner because of the patriarchy that exists in South Asian cultures. And she felt as if my quality of life is going to be uprooted for one. And also my reputation will be in shambles if I divorce this man. And she stayed in the relationship. And that's truly shocking. So again, this is not every South Asian woman's experience. Like my mom and my parents are like kind to each other. They're humane to each other. So like I said, that's not everyone's experience, which I think people have to recognize when consuming content. So thank you for that. Please continue.
Thank you. No, I'm glad that you, well, obviously I'm not happy that she went through that, but I'm glad that like, you know, stories of like that. But yeah, it's a very big thing in South Asian culture. And these men that are saying, oh, but it's not me. Oh, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but it happened and you've heard of it. And like the fact that you're pretending like you've never heard of it means that you're the problem as well. You know, you're pretending like your mom probably has gone through it and you're pretending like it's never happened. And that means that you're the problem and it's hitting a nerve because you probably know that you did something wrong and you're going through something that's probably negative, you know? So it's like at the end of the day, I'm getting these comments, but I know for a fact that they've seen it happen, you know? They just don't want to confront it. I think it's mostly like men that do it. It's not really female or woman, because they know that it happens to them. You know, they've gone through it themselves for the most part.
Within that, like, do you think that like male South Asian creators, like, do you think that they should be making like more content addressing the taboos, or do you think they're quote unquote not there yet?
I wish that they did do that. I feel like if they did start talking about it, I don't know if it would be received as well, because they are supposed to be like the macho, like, you know, people. Obviously that shouldn't be the case. That's why, you know, my partner and I try to talk about it more on our podcast and try to, you know, break those stigmas. But I feel like right now on TikTok, if people, like males, started talking about it, I think it would do well, because there aren't things like that. I just think a lot of people are not ready for it. And a lot of people haven't had like that. Maybe it's just me not meeting enough men that are like that, but I feel like a lot of people haven't had the emotional capacity to like understand what's happening.
Yeah, majority of the South Asian male content creators, specifically on TikTok that I've seen, unfortunately, I feel like they exhibit a lot more internalized hate or internalized xenophobia towards their South Asian culture more than South Asian women. And I talked a bit about this when talking with Rhea, how I feel like with coming into your culture, especially for Asian, I feel like women have gotten, it's a very weird dynamic where Asian women will get the chance or the spotlight to be proud of the culture. What I mean by that is, like, recently in, you know, the past, I don't know, like 5 years or so, we've seen, for example, Korean culture be spotlighted. So like Korean women will be like idolized, Korean skincare, for example. BTS is like the most highly touring band or something. I don't know, like they've reached a lot of achievements, and there's been like this flourishing for Korean culture in America. I lived in Los Angeles for 13 years. So like there's Koreatown. So in general, in that city, there was like a lot of affinity towards Korean culture. And I remember sitting back and thinking, okay, when's like my Indian moment going to come? When can I be like proud of my culture? Which is such a toxic mindset to have, which like for one, I should have been celebrating other people's wins at the times. But then it also went into the negative side of like exotification, which I stated when talking to Rhea that I feel like, or at least what I see is that South Asian women, not the men, but the women are the ones that are exotified. Whereas South Asian men are still being deemed as unattractive, and the really negative, harmful stereotypes of, you know, just South Asian men being creepy, pervy, et cetera, like in your Instagram DMs, the number of times I've had to hear that. And I think because of that, it's unfortunate to view that we have to view exotification as a positive thing that can boost your ego. But I think that's what happens with Asian women. And for the South Asian men, I think they can exhibit a lot more internalized racism. Like, because we were just talking about this, South Asian men, they can often be bashing just the South Asian women in general for being unattractive, undesirable, for complaining too much, and just being too, insert whatever negative stereotypes you can imagine. And then that will idealize white women and say like white women are the epitome of beauty in order to gain proximity to whiteness. So I wanted to ask you, what do you think the negative consequences of letting your internalized racism lead in that way? And yeah, I think we could just have a conversation about like how we see that in South Asian men, because in my experience, at least, I haven't seen many South Asian women do that to men.
I think since we are kind of fetishized in culture so much, I think that means that a lot of people also think that they can bring us down in the same way, because they see us as kind of like a fetish and like exotic, and they see us as this god in media sometimes. They feel like they have like that privilege. I think a lot of men, when they see people like on social media or something, and then they see them in real life, they are very quick to like judge them and disrespect them because they feel like they have easy access. Because I noticed that like even on the other end of the stick, they're very exotic in media, but then they're also very much disrespected. Like every single thing is nitpicked, like their skin color, or that like, you know, they're not light enough. There's colorism, and that's more towards the females. There's like the higher end where they're completely sexualized, and then like there's like the lower end where they're like completely disrespected. So it's like, I feel like there isn't really any winning with it. And it's really frustrating. And I obviously do wish these issues that that men go through as well were in media and like it was in the forefront.
Yeah, and I think hearing South Asian creators talk about similar traumas or similar taboos that you can't voice, like you said earlier, like you being a voice and being able to talk about it and put your experience into words. When I was like a freshman in high school and I was kind of like struggling with my identity, going on YouTube and like listening to creators talk about like their experiences and like talk about their relationship with their parents, hearing about how I'm not the only one. Like, I think that in and of itself is so special about the South Asian community and being able to acknowledge traditional values and the taboos that are upheld in our families and being able to go to PWIs and feel like isolated, but then also be able to know that out there in the world, there's other people. One way that a lot of people express their culture and their traditions is through clothing. What role does clothing and attire play into your life and your celebration?
I think every single day when I go outside, I have to wear something that's Labrinthev. Either I wear my tote bag that has like the Joy Bangla on it, or like I'm wearing my Air Forces that I painted, just something that I made just because like it makes me feel more like me. And I love wearing things of that I've made, like art stuff. I used to hate wearing South Asian clothing, like, you know, lehengas and just like saris and things like that. And I used to like really, really feel outside of my own skin when I would wear it. And again, it's because, you know, I grew up in like a very white dominated neighborhood. So I looked kind of like a sore thumb wearing it. I tried my best to get away from it. Like when we would go to parties with my family, I just did not want to wear it. And I would very much complain. But I think over the past few years, especially just going to college in the city and just meeting people that are more like me and, you know, getting out of that white type of area, I've just like started to understand myself and just see other people that are like me. And I think that has helped me embrace myself more. So now I just like love wearing any South Asian type of jewelry or like clothing. And I think I feel the most me when I'm wearing things like that. I never expected it to happen. And I don't think that like even my family from like Bangladesh expect like an American child to be just so patriotic and just be so in tune with my roots.
I relate to what you said about going to South Asian family or family friend gatherings, because when I would go to Indian family friend gatherings, I remember feeling so much superiority when I walked in with my jeans and a t-shirt, and then I would see like all the aunties, all the other first generation people, because I'm second generation, and like my dad, he's born in Germany, whole thing. But he lived in New Jersey, lived in New York for most of his childhood. So he's a US citizen. My mom's a Singaporean citizen, hence the reason I'm in Singapore. But as a first generation girl, South Asian girl, I felt as if I couldn't be like the other first generation girls who within California, I lived in a city, they lived in the valley, where there was a much larger group of Indian population specifically, not just South Asian, mainly Indian. Whereas in my school, I went to a predominantly white institution and it was an all-girls school. So it was, you know, heavy on feminism, but it was very heavy on white feminism. So the disparity was so huge that I felt as if I couldn't be like those girls that had communities that were predominantly Indian and predominantly brown. And I felt as if I couldn't wear the lehengas or the Indian jewelry like them, because there is a separation. And I think what a lot of brown girls go through and what they struggle with is the distance between being 0 or 100. I feel like brown girls have to feel pressure into choosing to be totally westernized and totally Americanized almost, if you're, you know, living in America, versus being totally inclined with being South Asian and being this pride and being this ultimate, you know, full on into the deep end. And what I really loved about your clothing, what I said earlier, was how it creates these modern silhouettes and these modern cuts and modern ways of Western fashion, but still incorporates a South Asian figure. So it's like this third culture that isn't always acknowledged by your parents, who are first generation immigrants, or other people around you that are non-South Asian people. So in general, I feel like it's a very long journey that you have, where you understand the level of comfort you can get with incorporating South Asian fashion into your regular clothing. So I wanted to ask you, because I remember listening to Difficultish and you mentioned how wearing a hijab to school was pretty traumatizing. Like, if that was my experience, I'm Hindu, but if that was my experience, I can only imagine that being traumatizing, how you were basically ostracized for wearing this South Asian religious clothing. So can you talk more about that experience? Could you explain to listeners?
So in sixth grade, I was very excited to start wearing hijab around Christmas time. I thought I was doing something so cool. I was doing it. My parents didn't tell me to wear it. I just wanted to do it on my own. And I was excited to go back to school after break and just surprise everyone with my hijab. I don't know. I was just like very excited about it. I was in sixth grade in like 2005 or no, I was in sixth grade in 2010. Around a time where like a lot of kids, you know, we were taught to be racist and just like be disrespectful. We never saw like representation. It was a very white dominated school. We had a lot of Indian people as well. So when I walked in with the hijab, I was the only person, I believe, in my class that had the hijab on. And it was very like taboo. Like no one knew what a hijab was really. It was also post 9/11. And I just felt like the air had changed when I walked in, and like all my friends didn't really want to like sit next to me or like be my friends anymore. I didn't feel as attractive anymore. I felt like the boys didn't want to talk to me. I don't know. I just felt very like singled out and cornered and alienated. I ended up just taking off the hijab after a month because, I mean, like kudos to the people that have been wearing it for, you know, their whole life, because it is hard to wear it because you get a lot of judgment. You get a lot of looks. And so, yeah, I ended up taking it off after a month just because like of how I felt.
Do you think you had anyone to like express those feelings to? Or did you just keep that like internally?
I think a lot of experiences that I've had in elementary and high school, like, you know, microaggressions that I faced, like racism that I faced, I don't think in that moment I knew what was happening just because I was so young. You know, I think like a lot of times, like I thought it was a joke, or like they would frame it as a joke. And like, if I did speak up about it, it would kind of just be like me overreacting. And so I never talked about it to anyone just because I didn't think it was a big deal. And then once I got to college and graduate school, and I started learning about, you know, these different things and definitions to these words, I started realizing like, oh crap, like I did face a lot of these things growing up, and I just like didn't have a word to it, and like I didn't know what was going on.
Also, I feel like growing up as a South Asian girl in America, a lot of what you are inclined to do is minimize the issues that you experience or the struggles that you experience. And I can only imagine, like, if I were to experience South Asian microaggressions, like when I was younger and I, you know, wasn't equipped with the language to name it or to identify it, I would not feel comfortable going to my mom personally, because growing up within Asia, there's going to be a totally different reaction to though, like, because it's very different, like growing up in Asia where the population is like full of Asians, like Asians are the majority population, and then coming to a country where Asians are the minority, that's a very different experience that they can't really offer advice on. And speaking of like this sort of disconnect between like South Asian parents and that generational gap, I'm curious about the journey becoming an artist with South Asian parents and like whatever dreams that they may have had as immigrants for the child. There's a lot of pressure, again, with like being a people pleaser as a South Asian girl. You also want to be the pleaser for your family because there's so much history behind all the efforts that they put in. And then the academic validation for me personally, at least in my experience, has been very prevalent because academic achievements is the like metric system for how success is measured. So that's been like a very central part of my life, at least. Even a country like Singapore where it's very hustle bustle, I feel like that's a large portion of my self-worth. So I can't really imagine going to an art industry. Not that I'm adept at visual arts, I'm very poor at visual arts, so that wouldn't be like my journey, but there is some closed off paths that maybe I would have taken or gone further down. Like I had a musical theater phase when I was in sixth grade. Maybe I would have taken vocal. Isabel knows about this. It's embarrassing. But maybe I would have been a kid that took vocal lessons. I will never know. But I was just asking, like, the experience of being a first-gen immigrant and going into art.
It's definitely been hard, and a lot of people expect it to just be kind of easy and just, you know, pursue it without really any repercussions. But for me, I think you really have to kind of work triple the amount that you would have. So, you know, I did go into the art field, but I had to, you know, go to grad school. I had to graduate early. I had to get a 4.0 and I had to like do all these extra things on top of me doing art. So like, I didn't go to school for art. I went to a school for English, biology, childhood education, and all these different things with the intention of, you know, being a teacher. So I couldn't really go to school for like art, you know, and I think that would have really made it a lot harder for me to pursue it. But I think telling my parents that, you know, I'm going to be a teacher eventually softened the blow of me being an artist, because I was killing it in school and I was still being an artist on the side and I was still doing my business on the side and doing everything else on the side. But I think it's really, really important to just do your passion and have your side hustle, but also don't forget about like the main thing that your parents do want you to do. And then eventually, if your art or like your side hustle does do well, you can do that eventually. And like your parents, at the end of the day, they do want you to be happy and they do want you to pursue something that makes you happy and, you know, make money, obviously, but you just have to like get to that point. So it was really, really hard for me to do even teaching. They obviously wanted me to be a doctor and like, they wanted me to just go into like law or something like that. Just, you know, the three traditional paths that they're used to. So that was hard to even just do teaching. But then I think they had nothing to really complain about once I started getting good grades and I was like doing everything at once, even though it was like basically killing me to do everything, like so many things at once. They saw that like I was capable of doing everything. And even now that I've graduated, you know, my parents asked me like, oh, when are you going to start job hunting for, you know, your teacher? And I'm kind of like taking a break right now just because I've been in school for so long and I want to focus on like my art and my business and everything. I feel like they understand that because I did do like the whole struggle of like school, and they have like their bragging rights with like telling everyone that I did my master's and everything. And so like, if I want to take a break, I feel like now I can, because like I did like the hard part already, you know?
Yeah. Thank you for sharing all of that. It's a really beautiful story though, I think, because often I feel like brown girls were minimized the barriers that do exist, because it can be ignored that we're not on the same playing field as white people that are going to the arts. So right. I think that was really true and real. And also with the struggle of trying to like appease your parents, I think in a video you said you can have your parents be included on the small wins, the small milestones that you reach. And in addition to having grad or masters as a backing to that, I think that's really real. And like, everyone's gonna have their own different relationships with their parents. Everyone's gonna have their different ways of interacting and navigating the scenario. But I think one of the most important things is having South Asian girls give themselves credit for the struggles that come with wanting to be a creator. So thank you so much for all of that. I wanted to end off with, for one, what is something you wish people were more mindful of or just were aware of when interacting with or talking about South Asian creators or South Asian representation, anything South Asian related? And then also, what advice would you give to your younger self as a South Asian girl in a predominantly white area who may have shunned her culture and her love for clothing, etc.?
I'm trying to think what.
Yeah, small question, right?
Yeah, just a small question. I think a lot of people have this idea that South Asian creators, they don't take them serious. Since we are still kind of like breaking boundaries and getting ourselves on the map, a lot of people still don't understand that we have to kind of make our own space in like a white dominated space. So that means we can have like our own people against us, you know? So sometimes it's really frustrating when the only support that we're getting is from brown people, just because like they understand what we're talking about and like the content that we make, but we're not getting the support because they're just like bashing our looks or like bashing whatever it is. They're just like nitpicking, and they're not supportive of the fact that we're trying to like make a name for ourselves or like represent other people like us in the space that's very heavily dominated by white people. So I think a lot of people, like what we said, like way in the beginning, talking about like, you know, there's Indian people in this space, but how about like Bangladeshi people, like blah, blah, blah. I think a lot of people are just like very quick to judge and hate on people, especially like brown people are very supportive of brown people, but they're also the biggest haters and very competitive. So I think it's very important for brown people to support one another and support other content creators, even if, you know, they're not in the same genre as you. But it's really important to support one another just because, you know, we need representation in all forms, you know. Something that I would tell my younger self. I don't know. I really try to like make amends with my younger self because I have a baby cousin and she's 8 years old and she wants to be like a artist when she grows up and sell her art online. So I feel like I'm making amends with her. But I think something that when I was younger, I was very doubtful of myself. And since I never saw myself in media and just because, you know, I grew up with like immigrant parents. So like I was always like very much taught to like be very successful in a different realm. And I never had like that sort of validation from other people. I think I would just tell my younger self that it's okay to dream bigger than what I thought life for me would be. I think I just expected like a very like tunnel vision life that was made for me, but I never knew beyond that just because I never knew about it, you know. That would be my one sentence to her.
And I think like even for me, I guess I'm like a child, but like I think that advice is so crucial for me as I go into college and as I think about what I want to do with my future. I think I get like asked all these daunting questions, like, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I'm like, I have no clue. But I think like that advice is so, so helpful. And I think even though it's like harder to conceptualize, I think implanting that seed is so important. And I think this conversation has been so productive, empowering. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And thank you so much for talking about your experience. I really appreciate it.
Of course, yeah. I said this last time talking with Rhea, but this is pure therapy, honestly. It's ironic sometimes because I will come on here, I will, you know, come with my own struggles personally with South Asian issues and coming to my own. And I feel almost like I'm preaching to people, like, okay, love yourself, guys. Like, this is so easy, right? No, because I still have, you know, yet to implement this into my real life, but it's really inspiring to see, like, how you're navigating like a third culture is what I really call it, because you know you're never going to feel truly connected if you're an Asian American, South Asian American. You're never going to feel 100% connected living in Asia, living in a white dominated America or Western world, you know. So I think the way that you're navigating it is really inspiring. And also, just this is totally for me, this, I mean, the listeners, they can like profit from this, but I'm in my like book reading era. I'm like reading so many books. I'm like doing good this summer with that. I wondered, because I'm like lacking South Asian representation in my library, I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for literature I can read that's South Asian. I know you're reading The Henna Artist. Yeah. And it's a pretty good book to read. So do you have any other recommendations?
One of my favorite ones, the book is called Daughters of Smoke and Fire. It's by a writer, her name is Ava Homa, I think. Such a beautiful book. I think one of my top favorites, like, ever. I love anything by Khaled Hosseini, all of his books. Obviously, my boyfriend's book, Headspun, poetry book. Let me see. There's a book called A Burning. I have, like, a bunch.
Yeah, it's on my list, yeah.
I have a bunch on my Instagram, Instagram highlights. And I also made a YouTube video on it. So I have, like, you have options. So you can see it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Want more of Dear Asian Girl? You can find us everywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Anchor. We're on everything. Can't get enough? Subscribe, follow, rate, review to get all the updates on the latest at DAG. Let us know your feedback and what we can do to improve. We also can be found on Instagram. Follow us at Dear Asian Girl to receive updates about our latest episodes and fun facts about the host. We'd love for you to reach out. DAG, Dear Asian Girl, a podcast dedicated to share the stories of Asian girls everywhere. For the Asian girl, by the Asian girl.